Good morning, and thank you all for holding. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question and answer portion. At that time, to ask a question, please press star one. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Kathy Harbin. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Elan, and thank you all for joining us today for the release of a new CDC Vital Signs. This month's Vital Signs is acute flaccid myelitis, also known as AFM, a rare but serious illness that causes limb weakness, mostly in children. We are joined today by CDC's Principal Deputy Director, Dr. Anne Schuchat, and by Dr. Tom Clark, a pediatrician and lead investigator for CDC's AFM team. They'll discuss what CDC has learned about AFM and our continued work to better understand this syndrome. I'll turn the call over now to Dr. Schuchat.
Thank you, Kathy, and thanks everyone for joining us today to discuss CDC's Vital Signs report. Each month, we focus on the latest data about a critical health issue facing our nation and what can be done about it. Acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, is a devastating illness for patients and their families. We know families are facing uncertainties when it comes to their child's recovery from AFM, and we want parents to know that we are keeping their children front and center and working with our partners to better understand this illness, its risk factors, and ways to treat and prevent it. AFM affects the spinal cord and causes limb weakness, mostly in children. There have been three nationwide outbreaks of AFM, starting in 2014 when CDC started tracking this illness. We've seen a seasonal pattern to this illness. Most patients develop AFM between August and October. Most patients had a mild respiratory illness or fever less than a week before they developed arm or leg weakness. There are important pieces of evidence that point to viruses, including enteroviruses in particular, playing a role in AFM. Today, in our Vital Signs report, we summarize what CDC has learned about AFM from the cases that were confirmed in 2018 and actions that doctors can take to better respond in the future. Doctors and other clinicians across the United States play a critical role. We ask for your help with early recognition of patients with AFM symptoms, prompt specimen collection for testing, and immediate reporting of suspected AFM cases to health departments. When specimens are collected as soon as possible after symptom onset, we have a better chance of understanding the causes of AFM, these recurrent outbreaks, and developing a diagnostic test. Rapid reporting also helps us to identify and respond to outbreaks early and alert other clinicians and the public. AFM has serious consequences for otherwise healthy. AFM is a priority for us at CDC. We're working with local and state public health departments to investigate AFM by reviewing each case, testing every specimen we receive, analyzing seasonal patterns, and collaborating with universities and the National Institutes of Health to conduct research. Our sustained work will help lead to more answers about this serious illness, such as why some children develop AFM and why these outbreaks are occurring. CDC's AFM Task Force of national experts is also playing a critical role in the AFM investigation by evaluating the current understanding of causes of AFM and strengthening the knowledge base about the best ways to support patients through treatment and rehabilitation. Now I'll turn the briefing over to Dr. Tom Clark, who's leading the CDC's AFM investigation from our Division of Viral Diseases. He'll summarize what we've learned in 2018 and discuss the way forward.
Thank you, Dr. Schuchat. And thank you again to everyone for joining us today. In 2018, CDC confirmed that 233 patients in 41 states had AFM. This was the third and largest outbreak since we started our surveillance for AFM in 2014. Similar to the AFM outbreaks in 2014 and 2016, most AFM cases were in young children. The average age was 5 years. Patients were severely affected by AFM, with 98% of them being hospitalized, 60% being admitted to intensive care units, and 27% requiring machines to help them breathe. We tested all the available specimens that we received from patients with AFM. All the stool specimens we tested were negative for poliovirus. Of the respiratory and stool specimens tested, about half were positive for enterovirus or rhinovirus, including EVD68 and EVA71. The spinal fluid was positive in just two cases, one with EVD68 and one with EVA71. Since 2014, we've tested spinal fluid of most AFM cases, and in only a few have we identified a pathogen. When a virus is found in the spinal fluid, it's good evidence that this was the cause of the patient's illness. Our 2018 data show that patients suspected to have AFM quickly received medical care. On average, patients were hospitalized within 1 day after they started experiencing limb weakness, and an MRI was performed within 2 days. Specimens were collected for virus testing within 2 to 7 days on average. However, suspected cases were reported to CDC anywhere from 18 to 36 days after onset of limb weakness. This delay hampers our ability to understand the causes of AFM. We believe that recognizing AFM early is critical and can lead to better patient management. Since there is no diagnostic test for AFM, doctors should make patient management decisions based on careful review of the patient's symptoms, physical exam findings, MRI, and other test results, and by consulting with infectious disease and neurology experts. To help with treating patients, the Acute Flaccid Myelitis Work Group and the Transverse Myelitis Association offer a 24-hour consultation service for providers who have questions about patients suspected to have AFM. You can find more about this online on our website. CDC is learning more about AFM through monitoring trends of AFM, researching possible risk factors, and conducting advanced lab testing and research to understand how viral infections may trigger AFM. We're collaborating with the National Institutes of Health to launch a study to better understand the causes and outcomes of AFM. We're also conducting enhanced surveillance for AFM at 7 children's hospitals across the United States. This will allow us to study the viruses circulating in those areas and how they might be related to AFM. In addition, CDC's AFM task force has identified several priorities to help research the cause of AFM. Strengthening and expanding education and outreach to healthcare providers, developing a network for collecting and sharing specimens for laboratory testing, using cutting-edge laboratory technologies, and implementing studies to help us understand why some children develop AFM, but most do not. As Dr. Shukat mentioned, CDC urges healthcare providers to recognize AFM symptoms, collect specimens early, and immediately report all suspected cases to their health department. CDC is working diligently to investigate every case, test every specimen, and conduct research to understand AFM and find better ways to diagnose, treat, and prevent it. Thank you for your attention. Elon, I believe we're ready for questions.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, for the first question. And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question today is from Evan Brown from Fox News.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for doing the call today. I have to ask the obvious question. Is there any belief, or even if not documented, but a belief or a working idea that the increased alarming number of parents choosing not to vaccinate against certain childhood diseases is any way related to the rise in AFM cases? I know that it's not something that is normally vaccinated for, but is there anything that you think is contributing to this?
Thank you for that question. The rise in vaccine-preventable diseases is of great concern. Obviously, we've been talking about the increase in measles this year with record levels, unfortunately linked to individuals who haven't been vaccinated as appropriate. There's not any known association with this outbreaks that we've been seeing of AFM and parental choices about vaccines, but thank you for the question.
Next question, please.
And our next question is from Mike Stobe from Associated Press.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Two, if I could. Could you update us on how many confirmed cases there have been this calendar year? And then also, Dr. Shukat had said something about it affects the spinal cord and causes limb weakness mostly in children. Could you say more about the best understanding of why it's mostly children who are affected and not so much adults? And if adults have been affected, how many? Thanks.
Thank you for those questions. I'll begin and let Dr. Clark continue. In 2019 so far, there have been 11 confirmed cases of AFM reported to us, and they come from 8 different states. In terms of the pediatric occurrence, I don't think we have all the answers. There may be some issues about children's immune systems and what they've already been exposed to, but let me see if Dr. Clark wants to add to that.
Thanks, Dr. Shukat. So we do want to remind everyone that AFM can occur year-round, and that it does occur in even-numbered years, not in odd-numbered years, not just even-numbered years. So we maintain surveillance year-round. And the testing and investigations we propose are important in every case. I think there probably is, we really do suspect viruses play a role and enteroviruses among the leading suspects. And so these are really ubiquitous infections common in childhood. And as you age, you've had many of them. So it may be that adults are less susceptible, whereas children are more susceptible. But we have a lot to learn through the research we proposed in understanding what triggers AFM in some children while most recover from these common infections. Overall, about roughly 93-95% of the cases occur in kids, but a handful do occur in adults.
Okay. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Maggie Fox from Independent Journalist.
Hi, thanks very much. You talked about it's good for the kids to get in as soon as possible. Can you talk about what treatment options there are, and has anyone found a way to slow the progression of the paralysis? Thanks.
You know, I'll begin again and let Dr. Clark expand. CDC has worked together with clinicians and experts around the country to develop interim considerations for treatment. There are not yet proven strategies that significantly change the outcome, but there's a lot of work going on. And one of the promising areas that we've been hearing about recently is early institution of rehabilitation or physical therapy. But let me let Dr. Clark talk a little more detail about the possible ways to treat or recover.
Thanks, that's right. We do have information for healthcare providers on our website that summarizes the experience that experts have had in using different types of treatment in patients with AFM. Unfortunately, we don't have good evidence for the benefits of any of those treatments. This is an important question for us and why we're working to identify every case and collaborating, especially with the National Institutes of Health on a prospective study to better understand the treatments that are given and what might improve the outcomes. We really do think that early and aggressive physical therapy and rehabilitation holds good promise to help kids strengthen the function that they have after AFM and regain as much strength and function as possible.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Allison Aubrey from NPR.
Do you know what percentage of the kids who get this have permanent paralysis? And also, another thing is just the unusual biannual feature of it. You mentioned you do have cases in odd years, but we tend to get them in even years. I can't think of something else that works that way, where it comes every 2 years.
Thank you. Let me take the questions in reverse order. The every other year pattern is intriguing. I want to say that we cannot assume that it's a long-term pattern because we've really only been tracking this since 2014, and we want clinicians and parents to be ready for a possible significant outbreak this year. It's one of the reasons that we're reporting these results right now in July, because it is every August that we start to see an uptick. There are some conditions where an every other year pattern has been seen. For instance, in rotavirus infections, that's what we see. But we don't right now have an explanation for the every other year pattern, and we really need to be ready to rapidly detect, report, and investigate each case this year and be ready for possibly a bad year this year. The issue of the outcome of paralysis, I'll let Dr. Clark let you know what we know so far.
There's been published experience from some of the cases that have occurred since 2014, and unfortunately it's, 70 or 80% or more of kids had ongoing limb weakness several months after onset of AFM. One of the things that the parents of affected children taught us last year is that, we were focused on disease cases of AFM as they occurred, but there are families and children living with AFM, and so it's a gap in our understanding and an important thing we've set about addressing. So we're going back to all the cases that occurred in 2018 to assess their muscle and function and strength and ability to perform activities of daily living at 2, 6, and 12 months after their illness onset. So we'll learn a lot more about the persistence of limb weakness after AFM.
Thank you.
Nope. I would just say that the biennial pattern is something that points us towards viruses, certainly, and we have strengthened our surveillance for enterovirus D68 in this network of seven children's hospitals we mentioned. And so we have 2 years now of additional experience, 2017, not much EVD68, not much AFM, 2018, more EVD68 and more AFM. And so this is one thing that's got us focused on EVD68, but we still have a lot to learn about how it plays a role in triggering AFM in certain kids.
Next question, please.
And our next question is from Michelle Cortez from Bloomberg News.
Thanks so much for taking the question. I'm wondering how many patients we've seen, if you have a good idea of how many across the board that there have been, and wondering if you think that because it has been increasing, did we see more in 2016 than we saw in 2014, and do you think that that pattern will continue, and until everyone's been exposed to this virus, do we have any idea of what percentage of people who've been exposed to a virus or something else might actually develop this AML?
Thanks for those questions. The cumulative total reported confirmed AFM cases to date for our figures is 570, and the 2018 outbreak was the largest so far with 233. In 2016, there were 149, and in 2014, 120. Now, it's important to say that we have strengthened the surveillance and increased attention, and I think parents and clinicians have also increased attention. But we do believe the 2018 outbreak was the largest yet. Does that mean that 2019 or 2020 will be even bigger? We really can't say. I think it's keen for us to make sure that we detect all the cases and that they're promptly cared for and we learn as much as possible. But I think it's too early in the course of this condition for us to understand fully what will happen in the future. One thing we're trying to do is be better prepared to learn as much as possible so that we can better treat and rehabilitate children who experience this and possibly work towards prevention or cures. Next question.
And our next question is from Jeremy Olson from the Star Tribune.
Two questions. One, I didn't know, I haven't seen a list of the seven hospitals where surveillance is being done, but my main question is, what is the list of possible things in common that differentiated the children who suffered these AFM due to common viruses, apparently? I mean, what's the possible things they had in common that could explain why they got so sick and experienced this limb weakness, whereas other kids just cleared the virus with little problem?
The list of hospitals, I think we could probably get after the call, make that
sure
available in terms of the collaborating pediatric centers. And that question that you ask about why this child and not the other child, why not the sibling who also had the respiratory infection, where we're pretty sure that the same virus was running around the family, those are critical questions and one of the reasons for the prospective investigations that are being developed to better characterize risk factors such as whether there are genetic predispositions that differ even within a family. But we don't actually have information right now about why this child. Most of the children that have been reported were previously healthy kids.
That's right, and we're also going back to all the cases in 2018 to do some structured interviews to look at potential risk factors. We've done this in the past and really haven't found anything unusual. As Dr. Shuket said, these have mostly been healthy children. No unusual patterns of exposures. And there are some studies that collaborators are working on to look for things like genetic or innate risk factors that might predispose to AFM.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
And our next question is from Jill Daly from Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Well, thank you. I have three questions. The first kind of follows up on what we were just talking about, genetic predispositions. Has there been any thought to families that might have had ancestors that had polio, that the children might have had grandparents, say, that had had polio, whether that would be some susceptibility? And my other two quick questions are, is there another disease that children might have been diagnosed with instead of AFM that would have looked differently and so they weren't undiagnosed in the past? And my third question is just the spinal cord sampling. Is there a possibility that instead of attacking the spinal cord, the virus had hit a different part of the body, neurologically affecting the child instead of coming through the spinal cord?
The question of genetic predisposition and family histories, I don't think we have that kind of information yet, but one thing to say is that there are a number of infectious pathogens that have a spectrum of conditions where some people are asymptomatic, some people have mild illnesses, and some people have very severe consequences. And in fact, with poliomyelitis virus, many infections are asymptomatic, and yet some individuals get paralyzed. So With viruses, we have seen that before, but we don't know right now exactly what's going on with the AFM outbreaks that we've been seeing. In terms of misdiagnosis, there are a variety of rare neurologic conditions that that are on the differential, and one reason that experts in transverse myelitis got involved with this is that they were being called upon to consult on these children. Diseases like Guillain-Barré syndrome, other relatively rare neurologic conditions may be there. But there's also a number of viruses, including enteroviruses, that can cause a variety of clinical syndromes, some neurologic manifestations and some fever or other conditions. You've probably heard us talking about Zika virus and about West Nile virus as conditions where there can be very severe neurologic complications, but most people have viral or maybe even asymptomatic conditions. Dr. Clark will expand.
One of the reasons that MRI is so important to us in the diagnosis of AFM is that it gives you a really specific picture of the part of the spinal cord that is involved in these cases. And so it's kind of diagnostic of AFM. It's also important to remember that it's a challenge. I think you were asking about a biopsy, for example, of a spinal cord or nerves to make a diagnosis. And it's a challenge to do that in kids who are previously healthy when your goal is to preserve function and help them regain strength. And so that's really not been an option for diagnosing AFM or for researching AFM.
Okay. Next question, please.
And our next question is from Leanne Winnick from CBS News.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could characterize the awareness among pediatricians, the first line of defense for these kids, and does it vary regionally based on where the cases have been?
Just to say that while this is a relatively rare condition, we have had reports from practically every state so that this isn't just a southern disease or a northern disease. However, the vast majority of pediatricians will never have taken care of a patient with this, and that's one of the reasons for the clinical consultation service that has been developed by the neurologic specialists who really want to help a pediatrician who's wondering whether that's what they have in terms of patients that they're seeing and what are the best ways to care for this. So in terms of the broader pediatrician awareness, Dr. Clark can make some comments.
Yeah, just to add that, you know, we mentioned that kids who present with limb weakness are hospitalized quickly and the MRI is done quickly and the specimens are obtained quickly for virus and other testing. But this delay of 18 days or more to report, you know, among the many things a doctor who's caring for a child with AFM in the hospital has to do, we want one of those things to be called the health department. We're also working with the doctors on the front lines who might see a child with AFM, for example, in an urgent care facility or just in their clinic. And so we're working with the partners we've also always worked with and reaching out to additional partners and provider organizations to make everyone aware and consider AFM and understand that it's important that it be reported to the health department.
And maybe just to close that out, as a disease that occurs seasonally, there may have been great awareness among pediatricians last October when the media was covering this extensively, but October was a long time ago, and so we do hope that today's report will be a reminder to clinicians and parents that the season for enteroviruses is coming, and, you know, if your child develops arm weakness or leg weakness, please seek medical care right away. If you're a clinician caring for such a child, remember that getting specialty assistance through neurology and infectious disease and the service that's been developed is important, and please do report to your health department so that we can understand what is going on across the country.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you. Our next question is from Molly Walker from MedPage Today.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I had a, it was following up on a couple of questions, but do you have data for what it looked like in 2017? You said 11 cases in 2019. Is this year trending like 2017 or is it higher so far?
This year looks like the past off years. So far, as we said, 11 cases in 2019. There were 35 total in 2017 and 22 cases in 2015. So these really are distinctive peaks in the even numbered years. But AFM does occur year-round. We confirm cases year-round and in odd numbered years. So it's important always to think about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Final question, please.
And our final question today is from Tom Avril from Philadelphia Inquirer.
Hi. Thank you so much. So I realize that the culprit hasn't been nailed down for sure, but has any thought been given to possibly developing a vaccine against one of those enteroviruses such as 68?
Thanks for that question. And so, you know, it's a long road to a vaccine, to develop and license a vaccine. It's important to really understand the cause of AFM or causes first. And so we're focusing on enteroviruses and EVD68. And especially, you know, we know certain viruses can cause AFM. We really want to know what explains this epidemiology we've talked about of AFM. Collaborators are working on proof of concept sort of studies on vaccines, but there's a lot to learn before we really have an effective prevention strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shuket and Dr. Clark, for joining us today. Thank you also to the reporters who have called in. If you have follow-up questions, you can call the CDC press office at 404-639-3286 or email us at media@cdc.gov. This concludes our call.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.